Hello and welcome. My name is Russell Trapper-Jones and this is Broadcast Focus, a channel dedicated to talking to the people behind the broadcast and media industries. Why? Because we're all individuals and we have our own stories to tell, whether it's our career, technology we've created, or a fascinating side hobby. I've got a good industry friend of mine who's no stranger to building hovercraft. And today I'm delighted to speak to third year University of Salford student in media technology, who's also a trustee and content director of the Mobile Phone Museum. Their name is Ren Wood, and it's great to have them with me. Ren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Russell.
I've seen you around quite a lot. We've met at SMPTE events, and it was really good to find out about what you're up to at university. As we know, the UK part of SMPTE has done a lot to get students from around the country involved, even though a lot of the events are in London. So I'm really pleased to see that's paying off and talk to you about what you've been up to. And of course, then we, what are you up to in your third year?
So third year is certainly challenging. There's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of stuff to kind of get together, chasing deadlines. And actually, third year is a lot more applied. You know, first and second year was a lot of the introduction to media and the introduction to the industry. Third year is really getting down into the nitty-gritty bits, so a bit more detailed systems design, detailed looking at codecs and encoding, technical approvals, and doing a major project, which means kind of bringing an idea from kind of just an idea to an actual concept and then writing that up.
Are you able to give us a sneak peek as to what you're working on?
Yeah, so my final project that I'm looking at is trying to build a smaller uplink vehicle than what is out there at the moment, because anyone who passed their driving test after January 1997 can only drive 3.5 tons. And a lot of the uplink trucks are uprated to 5.2 tons. So I'm trying to look at ways to bring that down as small as possible to make it so that the new generation of engineers can just get out and go, as opposed to trying to faff about with all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's been an eternal struggle against the axle weight.
Yes.
Fans. Yeah. Whatever size you're hitting, trying to hit, it's always been tricky. So I feel for you there. You're often doing the photography at the SMPTE events.
I've always kind of been making media, mainly videos, photos, done a lot of stuff with corporate and kind of blue chip companies. That's kind of been what's put me through, you know, uni, which is good. Done, got a bit of work through that. And it's just nice to be able to capture the moments of the events and things, because as you mentioned, SMPTE UK has been really good at getting students down. I mean, it's certainly a long trek from Manchester to London, but I've done it enough and run for that last train. And it's worth it just to be able to share the fact that the industry is welcoming and getting people together.
That's cool. And so so we stumbled upon this conversation then, really, about mobile phones. I guess the headline is it's a mobile phone museum, which in itself is an interesting idea.
Yes.
I remember walking around with my parents at museums and they were pointing out things that they had when they were children. And now we're in the position where there's plenty of people who said, oh, I remember getting that mobile phone. And so you've got a few with you, which which is great. And we'll have a look at those a little bit later. But how on earth did you get into the position of running a mobile phone museum?
So my dad has actually been in the phone industry since the early 1990s and was working at Vodafone at the time in Newbury, and the new generation of phones came out and they were just throwing them all in skips because, you know, you don't really, you just move on. It's like, no, well, someone's got started collecting them as a kind of personal thing because it's quite interesting. And then kind of became known that he had a collection, and then people started saying, well, can we give you stuff? It's like, well, it's not really fair for me to have it as my collection. It's got to need a vehicle to make that work. So kind of during 2020, you know, in lockdown when there wasn't a whole lot else to do, we got together. We've got six trustees including me, so we've got a nice team working together, and we've set up a registered charity in the UK that became the Mobile Phone Museum.
So I guess it's a bit like when, it's happened in my family, that somebody's got two or three figurines of a specific animal, and they say, oh, right, well, they like elephants.
Yes.
And then every Christmas they get another elephant, and then it all spirals out of control, and people say, oh, yeah, he's the elephant guy. And so yes. I guess the mobile phone's a bit more interesting, but your website here is mobilephonemuseum.com. So it's got this online presence. Is that your main way of reaching people?
So conceived during the pandemic when you couldn't really meet up. So we thought we'd get it online, reach the most amount of people. I mean, look at the analytics and the emails we're getting. You know, we have people looking at it from all over the world, which is great. And it's, we wanted to make it the most accessible way. And it's really a great piece of design. It was a lot of work to get it to where it is.
It's a really slick website. It's a really nice design.
Yeah, and the catalog where you can scroll and kind of try and find your first phone. We've got over 500 studio quality images, and many more to come. Just doing decent photography.
So your photography at work again?
It's not. We have a professional photographer who does that in a studio, which means it takes a bit of time and a bit of money. But we decided at the start that we were going to do it properly, and really, we're quite pleased with it. And for most of the phones, we have some sort of write-up. We've got extra content around it. So I've been trying to dig out all the old TV adverts, or we've got press releases, and just general stories. And the other thing was trying to do a bit of a talking history, because the people who created this stuff are still around, but not to be morbid, but they're not going to be around forever. So we've really been focusing on trying to capture the stories around the mobile phones and the little tidbits of information that just gets lost to history.
And so what's the interest been then? You can put something on the web, and then people tend to like pick it up, or have you seen like the press to say, all right, there's this weird website that's just come up, and then do you have industry people contacting you out of the blue? Or
So we had a launch event in 2021 when we actually launched. We had a night in London, invited loads of industry people, load of media, which is good. I mean we've blossomed. We've got over 6,000 devices now, of which over 2,700 are unique, which is a lot. And we do have people contacting us. You know, the inbox always has something that's a surprise, or the phone's ringing. I mean, I've basically ended up mopping up the media requests that weren't in. Being a student, my sleep schedule is a bit alternative, shall I say. So I've been on American radio at 2 a.m. I was on Radio 2 at midnight. I've done Radio 5 Live. There's just especially when something comes around, when it hits the media cycle, everyone's always interested. And it is global. You know, we've had people get in touch, you know, Germany, USA, Australia even. And we even were talking to people in Brazil. I mean, it is a global thing, because everyone has a mobile phone.
Yeah, and I think it is a fascinating story. And you know, there's two stories, I think, that go hand in hand and have evolved in parallel. There's the story of the technology behind mobile, of the actual phones themselves, and then there's the story of the technologies that have powered those, which we've agreed to talk about separately, because it's a whole thing in itself. But you know, just things like, you know, things like why is it that most of the time there's not an FM radio, or there wasn't an FM radio on many mobile devices, but then you go to other countries and there are FM radios, and then you know, some places they watch TV, some places they don't watch TV before streaming. That aspect of the technology, and what RF technologies can you build to deliver mobile service, in itself has been very interesting. But I think this picture here evokes everything you need to know about the move from the beginning of mobile phones to where we are now. You said previously that like video has defined what the phone is today. I've always liked this little image of imagining what it would be like if you did have a camera in one of the old Nokias. How much of a change was it? There's kind of a weird and wonderful way time? Was it just like a cliff over about a year or two when the iPhone came out and everything started becoming rectangular and black? Or is that an oversimplification?
That's an oversimplification, Emma, and I think you're actually jumping too far forward, because there's an interesting anecdote about what we as the museum believe to be the first camera phone. Now, that's a hotly debated topic because everyone is always first. And it's always interesting when we're trying to research this. A lot of it has already been lost to history. But the first one was the J phone, JSH-04, which was manufactured by Sharp for the Japanese market. And the first, the biggest operator, Docomo, turned it down. They didn't see the need for a camera phone. Ended up going to J phone. And they only agreed to make, they made 10,000 units, of which only 2,000 had a camera in because they didn't believe it would sell. But then the market spoke and the camera unit flew off the shelves. And the iPhone it is another interesting anecdote, because it almost seems to be remembered in a kind of rose-tinted way. Because initially, you know, the N95, which was the Nokia phone at the time, outsold it for, you know, a year and a half. Ish initially.
Yeah. I think the reason people bring it up, though, is because it led the way for not having a keyboard.
Yes.
And fundamentally, as you say, the market's spoken, it's almost true that there are no more keyboards left.
Yes.
And so, you know, whether or not it sold well, it ended up defining the shape of things to come. And so, yes, you know, it's hard to get away from that shape. And to my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, like the biggest deviations have been when they've made them folded. So it's really, you know, making two shapes now.
Yeah, it is interesting that looking forward, because the folding phones have definitely come through and they are pretty mainstream now. We're on the fourth, fifth generation now. And, you know, you had the teething problems, as you do with any new technology. But it's really interesting to see what's coming up and, you know, rolling displays and making it kind of being pulling out as opposed to unfolding or combining the two. There haven't been any actual phone prototypes, but I know that Samsung Display, not Samsung Mobile, there's a few prototypes floating about, and it is kind of changing what it means for media. Or are we even, you know, looking at media? You know, when we were at the Sky event, the Simpty event in January, where they put up the kind of word cloud of how do you think we'll be consuming media? VR and AR was there quite significantly. So who knows? Who knows?
So you've got 6,000 phones.
Yep.
Where do you store them all?
Well, it's over 6,000, which is over 6,000. Quite 6,000 if you include duplicates. So it is certainly a challenge, because it's a lot of batteries, which, as if anyone knows, if you've tried to ship anything, batteries are a nightmare. But it's not just lithium batteries, it's NiCad. I think even one of them was lead acid because it was so old, and they require management. So when we get a device in, we survey it, see what it is. If there's corrosion, we try and kind of clean it up. Unfortunately, some phones we've got them in and they've just been completely destroyed because it's been corroded away. We try to remove the batteries from all of them. We have a partner called Genuine Solutions, and they work on like e-waste recycling and recovery. Mm-hmm. And we've got some space in their warehouse where we store most of the collection. Okay. And then we have a storage unit for all the collateral stuff. And they're all catalogued, and we know where each one is in the box, so we can go and get it if we need it. And then, of course, we have a selection of the kind of greatest hits that we keep around.
Although it is an online collection, they are out in the wild. You have an exhibition. Is this down in Cornwall?
It is down at PK Porthcurno, the Museum of Global Communications. So, yeah, they have the Telegraph Museum there, where the cable landing point was and still is, I believe, for a lot of fibre going transatlantically. We've got an exhibition in there until October 2024. With a nice collection of mobile phones and generally kind of talking about the history. It's called Going Mobile. So it was a lot of effort to get it in, and it's the first time the museum collection has actually been out to the public. And we're really pleased to finally get something out there, and we're looking to do more events in future.
Let's hope that can happen again, different places. Very appropriate place. It's a shame it's so far away from everywhere.
Yes.
If you're in Devon, you're not complaining.
It is certainly a trek.
So being a charity, how are you funded? Do you need donations? Is it a donations thing or...?
So we mainly partner with Vodafone. They're the headline sponsor of the museum. Who kind of fund us. And then there are other kind of companies that we work with. Either they donate a large amount of devices or time or knowledge or equipment. And we do, accept general donations like any charity. And also we accept donations of devices. So in running a charity is certainly there's a lot of oversight, because the charity commission is certainly something that you don't want to get on the wrong side of, but it's one that we're very very proud that we have been recognized as a nonprofit, and it is the right vehicle to preserve it, that shows that we're doing it for the general good as opposed to just a bit of self-interest.
Yes. So talking about those donations then, you've got this most wanted list.
Yes.
So you're at a position where you don't want anything, like simply anything, because there's a good chance you've already got it.
We are getting to the point where we are saying a polite no thanks to a few devices. But still, this is the most wanted, the list of stuff that we really kind of want to get our hands on. Some of them we're not even sure exists in the wild, but it's worth a go. And even if you do have a device that you don't think we have or we might have, just get in touch and we'll be happy to let you know. And there's some really interesting ones there, like the Google Project Aura, that again, there's pictures out there, but it's difficult to see if one actually made it to market.
Yeah, so it could be there are only a few in existence anyway.
Exactly. And we have certainly done well with that, especially with some of the rare prototypes we've got. We have been afforded some very nice donations. We're just keeping them and kind of documenting about them. And
this Pepsi one looks intriguing.
There's food. There is a KFC phone that we've got. there's a Coca-Cola phone, I believe. There's just... Yeah. So many that are some weird and wonderful things that have fallen out of various marketing departments. It is quite interesting.
Cool. All right. Well, look, so if anybody's got one of these in particular, then be absolutely great to hear from you.
Yes.
So let's have a look. What wonders have you managed to pluck out of your storage?
I'm very interested
to see what you've got.
Quite the collection. So we've got the kind of first kind of UK mobile phone.
Let me fit on the screen.
Not really, no. The Vodafone VT1. So that is, this was what the first phone call was made on, which is crazy. And, the fact that it's just so big and heavy. And when we go to schools, because we do an education side of things, kids are like, really? Is that what phones used to be like?
So can just show us again how that splits up. So you're expected, or you can hold it, but you're expected to put it down. And then
very which heavy. So the handset is kind of there. So you can, dial your number and go from there. And it is just kind of, this was the peak of technology in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And then... there's another phone that we got that actually we've ended up documenting a lot of, which is the XL, the Technophone, made by a guy called Nils Martinsson. And it's actually, if you can believe, the first pocketable mobile phone, because the marketing material is that it would fit in a top shirt pocket.
Oh, well, that's ambitious. There are plenty of other pockets which I would have gone for first.
There are. And it is certainly an interesting device to have around, and the story behind that. We've also got...
If the antenna reaches beyond your shoulder, then it's probably not fitting in your pocket.
The antenna does unscrew, so you can go with that. And then the iconic Motorola... this is the 8500X, but the 8000X was the original, done by Martin Cooper, who made the first phone call on a variant of this in 1973. And he called his rival at AT&T going, "I'm calling you from a cellular phone," which, you know, I think that's quite common with engineers.
So these initial phones, are they based on digital technology or are they analog?
So they are analog. So tacks, amps, and there's a French variant that escapes my mind. They were completely analog, and yeah, were using vast amount of spectrum, and these are the ones that you do worry about some of the RF emissions when they were right next to the side of your head. But yeah, they were completely analog. The real first generation of mobile phone networks.
Mm-hmm. Understood. And were they eavesdroppable because it was analog?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think there is some talk of that, but it comes down to the actual thing that people were more worried about was people stealing it. You know, because this was a few thousand dollars. But there's one that there's a story, an anecdote that I found that's amazing from the late 1990s around Canary Wharf, where they were talking to business people and they said, "Well, if someone tries to steal it, it's quite weighty. You just, you know, you can deal with it pretty swiftly."
I can't imagine. I mean, if there are not many of them, again, it's the classic problem of art theft, isn't it? What do you do with it? You got the Mona Lisa, who do you sell it to? And you know, sooner or later, if you're one of 100 people,
yes,
you would have been initially, then it's a bit of a different.
Definitely. Cool.
So what else have you got?
Box
under your desk or something?
I have got a box under my desk. It's we've got actually a phone that had its birthday recently, the Nokia Communicator 9000, which was kind of opens up and was kind of definite mobile workstation, and being able to talk in text and actually do, you know, telnet in on the go over the 2G network, which was really quite impressive, and kind of paved the way for really working on the go and making it the all-in-one device. And yeah, it was released 28 years ago last week, so
It's very reminiscent of the Scion and like PDF.
Exactly.
Just with a lot of mobile.
Yeah, and data services as well. And then I've got another few devices. The first devices that was launched on the 3 network in the UK, Motorola A920, which has a camera in the top, which is swivels round, because, you know, why would you need two cameras on a device when you can just have one? And it was such a the devices that launched with 3 were, looking back, they were all hyped up, but actually there was a lot of negative press around it because they were just so bulky and the battery did not stand up. I mean, this one, the battery didn't last very long. So Motorola, I think it lasted about 45 minutes. So Motorola included a second battery in the box.
Wow. 45 minutes is not long. Is that chat time, do you mean?
45 minutes of call time.
Wow.
And that was when video calling was kind of the thing. And it was billed to be the next greatest thing. But at 50p a minute, the industry was a bit.
You'd want a 45 minute cut off, wouldn't you?
Yes.
It's like a free Zoom account.
Exactly.
It should have come bundled.
Yeah, it all comes down to what the marketing department decided at the time and what was technically possible. Mm-hmm. And then we get on to what's really interesting about media and really, as you discussed, the different kind of competing standards for mobile television, which was the kind of, there's the one that everybody's heard of, the ill-fated DVB-H, which just kind of was billed to be the next best thing, and then it wasn't. But there's actually the phone before that, which was the Lobster phone, VM, Virgin Mobile, launched it, which actually used IP over DAB, the radio spectrum, to get video content out to this device, which was just crazy. They spent $2.5 million on a marketing campaign with Pamela Anderson, and it just completely flopped. It was BT Movio was the service, and it was supposed to be mobile TV, and it just never really took off because, you know, you're going to get, I was looking at the specifications, it was a like 320 by 240 image at 12.5 frames a second.
It's stretching the definition of video at that point.
It is. It's more like a slideshow. And then there is the...
The trouble is with the more modern phones, they get smaller, so it's harder to see. So this is the one that we just looked at, isn't it?
Yes.
We've got this.
Lobster 700 TV.
So there was space, presumably. They got space on one of the national multiplexes on DAB. And then
video over that. They put the video over DAB IP, but then they put the program guide, so basically red button, over 2G.
Right.
Which was such an innovative way of thinking, you know, the fact that it just is such a, you know, it...
Has Pamela?
Yes, there is the video, which is just
chillaxing, watching DAB.
Exactly, as you do.
Don't think you do in her country.
Well, exactly. And that, you know, the mobile TV standards went around. There's the kind of the DVB-H ill-fated one. This is the Nokia 7710. Which there is the Nokia 7700, the prototype before this, but that's down in the exhibition in Porthcurno. And there's actually a kind of backpack module that had the streaming antenna in. It just uses pogo pins to connect to the back. And this was DVB-H, and it was going to be kind of, you know, mobile TV, more linear. And actually, looking back on it and looking what we have now all over IP, it was multicast, so maybe we've kind of missed a trick there, because, you know, having to do, you know, simulcast to, you know, where you're sending a video feed to everyone, it's quite bandwidth intensive, wherein in the fact if you can receive it on multicast, you get the image.
Yeah. No, you're quite right. I mean, everyone's still trying to get the best of both worlds across the board. So what we've got there, we've got plenty of... It's a bit like a controller, isn't it, really?
It is. This kind of horizontal format that fits quite nicely in the hand with the specific buttons. And then, yeah, the streamer module on the back. Exactly. I'm running, you know, Nokia Symbian OS, which was very... which was good for the time, but, had its downfalls.
Cool.
Yeah, and then I've got a few more. The kind of one, the variant that fell out of the Asia Pacific market.
Love the Asian phones.
Exactly, Samsung STH-Z130, because, you know, they came up with really nice names. And this was, if I remember correctly, I think this was a MediaFlow device, which was Qualcomm's version of, you know, proprietary technology to get video out, and, you know, the fact that the screen just rotates so you can watch your telly is just crazy. And another one of the rotating cameras, because,
you know,
that was all the rage. And again, a standard that did actually kind of take off in the Asia market.
That's another of those dodgy cameras, isn't it? Says it is. 176 by 220.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Really high quality there.
And it doesn't look, I don't know, perhaps it's just the way, it doesn't look like it's a 16 by 9 screen. But at that size, it doesn't really matter too much whether it's sideways or not.
No, exactly. Exactly. And then there's one more.
Nowadays, you can just rotate the whole phone anyway, and nobody does. So We kind of solved exactly the problem just by always doing it in portrait.
The curse of vertical video, a video engineer's nightmare. But it's interesting, you know, seeing around video formats and the fact that I was speaking to a person who was shooting fashion shows, and they shot everything in 4K because it meant they could get a 1080p vertical in the middle.
Yeah.
Because vertical content, I don't know. I personally don't like vertical content, but, you know.
I think the issue is, and you know, doing it like pan and scan, so to speak, on 4K is a good idea. But you have to have someone who's good enough to also be thinking, well, I need to make sure that
yes,
I've got, you know, you've got to frame it right in two exactly. different dimensions at once, which, yeah, hats off. People who can do it, that's great.
Yeah. There's one more from the collection that I've got, which is the Samsung Galaxy Beam, which okay. looks fine until I flip it over and it actually had a projector in the top.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It was not the highest resolution and slightly not the brightest colors, but the fact that in a phone that's mm-hmm. not too dissimilar, it's not the thickest, is actually got a projector in the top and just another way to consume media.
The promise is really good.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, think more phones should have that. It's, you know, share with friends, just throw it up. Yeah, and it's just such an interesting way of thinking about it and the different things that have been tried.
Mm-hmm. It's a good excuse. Is it, why were you meeting with your friends down that dark alley? Well, we wanted to watch yes. on the projector. And
exactly. It was convenient.
It's the only way we could see the actual screen. Because I can't imagine it's that bright.
It's not, no. yeah, it's just
2012.
Yeah, so that's jumping forward. Gosh. And it's, yeah, really.
You can tell with the form factor, it's of that era.
Yeah.
Nothing on the front. So you innovate on the sides.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. You can see the little slot there.
And it's just quite, yeah, interesting to see what will come next, because you get into, and you alluded to it earlier, the kind of phrase that the sea of smartphone sameness. Yeah, ultra bright 15 lumens.
I like this. I'm not quite sure how they reconciled those two facts, but
it's the marketing department. It's great. Exactly. They come up with the best things.
But the thing is, if you take to the marketing department a one lumen projector and a 15, then they're going to say that the 15 is ultra bright. So
exactly. So yeah, it's kind of getting to the point now where we all have this kind of black slab in our pocket that does everything, and that we're really moving towards everything is internet IP based. You know, the fact that phone calls are still used, but then you've got people doing WhatsApp calling or Wi-Fi calling even, or over Telegram, or choose your platform of choice. And video calls are, you know, that pandemic forced that forward, and that consuming media is kind of a video first thing, and getting that across with the extra capacity of 5G is quite interesting how they're doing it. But, you know, is there a kind of alternate reality where we're all getting terrestrial TV, or there's even like satellite TV, you know, it's SDMB, which was satellite broadcast of DMB, digital multimedia broadcasting, I believe. And it's just crazy, some of the standards that were dreamt up.
I think a lot of those come from the traditional view, which missed the boat on streaming. Yes. Is that, well, we have to broadcast it, so let's find another way of broadcasting, which is a little bit different. And it's only with DVB-I and ATSC3 that broadcast standards have really caught up with the idea that at least do it IP based.
Yes.
Even if, exactly. Or no. So finally, fully IP. But I guess there's still the best of both worlds to get, isn't there? Where you've got transmitters, as you say, even if it's effectively multicast because you're broadcasting it out. But then you need the hybrid angle to do it in a modern way. So I can only imagine that's why a lot of these things fell by the wayside. And I do remember, though, coming back to DAB for that reason. I'm sure there was a suggestion initially to send like album art and stuff over DAB, but I don't know that got implemented, at least in this country.
No, it's interesting looking at all the regional variations and how, you know, even as much as we like to think we're unified, there's still, you know, there's still regional variants of a lot of stuff. And we're finding that as we dig through the archives and people donate stuff, oh, well, you've got this Samsung phone, but that's the Asia Pacific one. So it's got slightly different hardware. I mean, some of them even have different designs. It's the same hardware underneath, but the thing that we found that kind of threw those television standards to the wayside is it needed hardware adoption. It needed specific hardware, which wasn't subsidized by the media companies, which is viewed to be kind of why it failed. Because, you know, you throw a bit like you could take the example of Netflix subsidizing the Edge, like Network Edge, and putting boxes in there. That gets it out to the population because they're subsidizing it. So maybe... yeah, it's an interesting reality we could have had, and yeah.
I think it's really, really good to see the different phone designs. Really liked it, and love to talk another time perhaps about the just about the Japanese phones and the technology. And that's a fascinating branch that we can talk about another time. Thanks very much for digging into the archives, risking your life pilfering through those batteries.
Definitely, definitely.
I hope there haven't been too many incidents with those.
No, no. There is the infamous Note 7. We may or may not have one that is stuck in two LiPo bags in the bottom of somewhere. Which is just, yeah, there have been a few that we've been like, might want to put this outside, but yeah, it is
good to be shared on the garden, so
exactly and share the mobile phone museum and get more people interested.
Yep, so mobilephonemuseum.com, and so on there's donor section as well as checking through the most wanted.
Yes,
see if you've got a Google Project Ara somewhere in your back pocket that you'd forgotten about. And then, you know, you can just access the whole catalogue. Do what I've been doing, as we've been talking through, and just searching, find these things and have a look. Enjoy the museum for what it is. If you're near Cornwall, if you want to go there on holiday for the summer, then good excuse, go to the exhibition. And so hats off to you, your dad, really well executed. It's a great website. So his history we can all get behind, at least with our technical hats on. And however long you've been around using mobile phones, I think there's some interest there to dig into.
Definitely. And, you know, it's having done a few of the educational workshops with younger, you know, I did a workshop with the Scouts, and they were like, the phones used to look like this, let alone they used to look like this. So it's really getting out there and showcasing the design and going, actually, no, this slab in your pocket, there's a lot more to it than you think, and inspiring the next generation of designers and engineers, really. That's the main thing. Being able to go, look, we're preserving it because we didn't really see that anyone else was.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point of view, and it's a bit like it makes me feel a little bit like cars now with there's very little you can do to the engine. You can't get to some of the engines and things like that, so it's not as if people don't know there's something under there, but the tendency then to play with it and to tinker and understand what's going on is diminished. And then similarly, like, we used to be able to literally see a camera and rotate it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got this, antennas went through these multiple iterations until they finally went inside the phone. And now you can't really see anything, and the design's a lot less interesting.
Yeah.
I'd just say, like, we've got good phones now, but I'm just looking for the next ultra bright 17 lumen projector. Exactly. If I can get one of them in my next phone, I'll be happy. Look, thank you very much. Do appreciate you joining me on the show. Everybody who's been watching has enjoyed that, please hit like, pop a subscribe on if you can. So thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you, Ren, for having a chat and bringing your phones along.
Sounds good. No, thanks for having me on.